When is a death considered good news? Nice light question to start us out this morning. When is a death considered good news? So, I would say probably rarely, but there are situations where we could probably say, yes, that's the case. Maybe one would be if the person who has died was cruel or was tyrannical. You know, an abuser, an oppressor. Think on the national or international level, a Hitler or a Stalin. We may not celebrate the death, but at least we might feel a sense of relief when someone like that dies. Or on the flip side, when someone dies in the midst of a heroic act, where they've accomplished something great. Now, again, we might not celebrate their death for sure, but we celebrate what they have accomplished even alongside our mourning over their loss. Maybe if a loved one is suffering physical, mental, emotional decline. And again, we don't celebrate death, but it can bring a sense of comfort when it comes. So these would be some situations where we might view death as good news, but certainly not in the majority of situations. I mean, we could talk about things like suicides, about overdoses, about school shootings, and we would say in many of these situations, it's absolutely not good news at all. And you think, do we really have to talk about this in church this morning? I mean, like, this is the worst sermon ever. But you realize the paradox of the Christian faith is that it is centered on the death of one man. John Ortberg wrote these words. He said, somehow, Jesus' death is central to his story in an unusual way. If you read the biography of any famous person, even if their death was a prominent story, so think like Abraham Lincoln or Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr., even if their death was a prominent story, it will be only a tiny part of their biography. But within a few decades of Jesus' life, four biographies were written about him, and the story of his death takes up a disproportionate amount, about one-third of each one of them. And we could talk about the teachings of Jesus. Now, you compare that with other religious teachers. You could talk about Buddha. You could talk about Muhammad. And their death doesn't really factor into their teachings at all. But in the case of Jesus, his death is a central part of his message. How is this? Well, over the next few weeks, we want to explore that thought. We begin a new series of sermons this morning. It's called Conquering Death by Death. And what we want to do is we want to look at the Gospel of Matthew and specifically walk our way through the way that Matthew, one of those biographies of Jesus, the way that it recounts what happened on the day that we know as Good Friday. Now, we call it Good Friday. But you would certainly, as you read, make the case that it was probably the worst day of Jesus' life. As he's arrested, as he's tortured, as he's ultimately executed. Not a good Friday for him. And yet, even on the worst day of his life, we see Jesus walking through these events with purpose and with power and with self-restraint like no other. Even as terrible things are being done to him, you never get the sense that he's out of control. And of course, what he accomplished in that death has changed the world. And so we want to reflect on it together, and we're going to work our way through those events of Good Friday. And so we go to the text that Daylene read for us. This is a long reading, and we're not going to read it again, but I'd encourage you to pull it up, have it open in front of you as we reflect together on this story. And where we go is to Gethsemane. Now, to put the text in context, let's think together about what was happening in the run-up to these events. So it is the time in Jewish society of Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So some of the holiest days of the Jewish year. So Jews from about 15 miles around Jerusalem have all come together in Jerusalem, and some have come even further. And so there are tents and encampments around Jerusalem of these Jewish pilgrims who have come for the celebration of these holidays. They've gathered at the time when there is messianic expectation. So they've come and they're waiting for a Jewish Messiah to come, and they think, you know, right around this time of Passover and celebration could be the time when he comes. So it is a time of passion and excitement as people descend on Jerusalem. The Jewish leaders have by now decided that Jesus is a threat and he must die. But they certainly don't want to arrest him. They certainly don't want to do all of this publicly when passions are running high for fear of causing a riot. And then Jesus' disciple Judas gives them the out they're looking for. He comes to them and offers to hand Jesus over to them privately. And with all of the pilgrims around Jerusalem, I mean, they would never have been able to find Jesus privately without an inn like this. And so Judas offers them that inn and is prepared to bring them to Jesus. And as we see in the text, where he brings them is to Gethsemane. Now, 25 years ago, I had the privilege of being in Israel, and we walked down the Mount of Olives and came to an olive grove that very likely is Gethsemane, or at least something like what Gethsemane would have been. It's an olive grove. There are trees there that produce olives. Gethsemane, that word, literally means oil press. And so they're likely in this garden, this grove where Jesus and his disciples were, where apparently they liked to come. There probably would have been an oil press. Maybe Jesus is praying beside a press. And what would have happened is olives would have been crushed with a millstone, and the pulp would have gone into a basin. And then they would have put it in a basket and crushed it again with a weighted stone to press the oil out. The irony is interesting when you think about what Jesus was experiencing. As he's praying, did he feel crushed? Did he feel pressed upon as he's praying beside the oil press in this grove? Here in this text, you see Jesus as you never knew him. The Jesus we never knew. This Jesus, he is agitated. He's sweating. He's falling down and getting up again and falling down and going off to pray by himself and then coming back to his three disciples, Peter, James, and John. And then going back and praying and then coming back. I mean, it's a little bit like a kid who's just had a nightmare and keeps coming back and forth to mom and dad. Jesus is almost seeming needy in this text. Jesus, like we've never seen him. I mean, he's never been like this before. And it's not for lack of being in difficult situations. I mean, he's on a boat in the middle of a storm. The boat is threatening to capsize. His disciples are panicking. And what's Jesus doing? He's sleeping. He at one time was going to be thrown off of a cliff by the people of his own hometown. And he just kind of like slips away quietly through the crowd as they're looking for him to kill him. It's amazing. He's faced down demons. He's cast them out. We've never seen Jesus like this. So we could ask the question, what caused him to be sorrowful and troubled the way he's described here? What caused it? And we don't know exactly what caused it. I mean, but we can speculate. We could speculate that maybe it was the physical horrors that he was about to experience. I mean, crucifixion was a known punishment at that time. Jesus had probably seen others who were crucified, so he maybe knew something of what to expect. Is that what has him sorrowed and troubled? Maybe, although as the story advances, we see that even as he is facing the hardship, even as he's facing the torture, I mean, he is poised and strong. So it would seem like maybe it's more than that. I mean, maybe Jesus here in Gethsemane is, he's still considering his options. What could he do? Well, I mean, he could. It's a time, as I said, of heightened messianic expectation. I mean, he could whip the crowd up. He could perform a spectacular miracle. He could start the revolution that so many of the people have been waiting for and wanting him to start. He could do that. Or he could kind of do the opposite. I mean, he could just continue and sneak over the mountain and go out into the Judean wilderness. And he could start a little community there based on study and quiet meditation and just kind of disappear from the public scene. Could do that. He could wheel and deal with the powers that be, with the Jewish leaders or the Roman leaders, and try to strike some kind of deal. And I mean, he could be kind of a reformer from within. You know, if he got in with the people in power instead of antagonizing them, think of the good that he could do. Maybe he's weighing these options still. But he knows that when he leaves Gethsemane, as things currently stand, he will have no options. Is that why he's troubled and sorrowful? I suspect most of all it has to do with the spiritual reality of what he is facing. N.T. Wright says this, "All the strands of evil in the world seem to rush together upon him. The power-seeking politics of the local elite, the casual brutality of imperial Rome, the disloyalty of Judas, the failure of Peter, the large systems which crush those in their way, and the intimate, sharply personal betrayals, and everything in between." And the evil isn't just swirling around him. It's going to be on him as he takes the dark and heavy load of the sin of the world upon himself and experiences a catastrophic rupture in the beauty of the Trinity. God the Father turns his face away. He faces a break in this fellowship that he has always known, God the Son with God the Father and God the Spirit. I mean, he knows in his head it's coming. And yet, I imagine the weight of the reality of it settles on him. And he is sorrowful and troubled. That's Jesus in Gethsemane. But then you see it by the end. you see this dramatic change in him. I mean, in Gethsemane, we see the Jesus we never knew. But by the end, he is resolved. And so he stands before his disciples and he says, the hour has come. The Son of Man is handed into the hands of sinners. Let's go. Here comes my betrayer. To Judas, the betrayer, he says, do what you came for. To his overeager disciple who's pulling out a sword, he says, put away your sword. Jesus is back in command. The question then is how does that happen? How does he go from fear and angst to resolve, what the British would call the stiff upper lip, right? How does he make that transition? Or to frame the question the way that I did in the title of the sermon, where was Jesus' battle won? Well, we see where his battle wasn't won. It wasn't won in comfort and care. I mean, he sought that from Peter, James, and John in the grove. And they just had nothing left and couldn't stay awake. And so Jesus is utterly alone. No comfort and care from his disciples. Jesus' battle was not won in armed warfare. I mean, we have his overeager disciple who, in another text we learn, was Peter, surprise, our favorite impetuous disciple, who pulls the sword, cuts off an ear, almost certainly was aiming for more than just the ear. An aside, here's the only place in the scriptures that we have a Christian acting violently towards someone else. And Jesus puts the kibosh on it immediately. All who draw the sword will die by the sword, he says. He says, I can call on my Father and he'll put at my disposal 12 legions of angels, 60,000 angels. If I wanted to resolve this thing by battle in violence, I could do that, Jesus says. That's not where the battle's won. Where's the battle won? In passionate, trusting prayer. Verse 41, he says to his disciples, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Now, Jesus is talking to his disciples, but I also wonder if he's at least partially talking to himself. Because certainly in Gethsemane, he was tempted. Certainly in Gethsemane, he felt weak. And so maybe he's saying to himself, watch, keep awake, be vigilant, and pray. And you see his prayer, really just one sentence. My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. What's the cup he's talking about? Well, in ancient times, one way to execute a criminal was to give them a cup of poison, and they knew exactly what it was, and they had to drink it. That's how Greek philosopher Socrates died. Handed a cup, has to drink the poison. Jesus said earlier than this to his disciples, I have a cup to drink, and eventually you're going to drink it too. Maybe this is what the writer of Hebrews had later on when he says that Jesus tasted death for everyone. He has the cup of suffering and death to drink. And he doesn't want to take it. But it's his mission to take it. It's why he came. And so we see Jesus kind of at war with himself here. You know, Jesus has two natures. He's got the divine and the human together in one. And the divine nature of Jesus knows what is happening and knows exactly what he has to do. And the human nature just wishes and hopes and prays that there's some other way. And so in prayer, we see him coming to a place of peace where the two natures come together. And he prays, not as I will, but as you will. May your will be done. He prays, and after this passionate prayer, prayed more than once, he's in a sense prayed that will of God into himself. He's declared his trust in God and in this plan. And he is ready to move ahead. Now, there's a lot that Jesus experiences on Good Friday that was for him alone, that isn't for us to imitate. But I'm pretty confident that if we're going to imitate anything here from Jesus, it's his approach to prayer. When you're facing your battle, I invite you to join Jesus in praying the unfailing prayer. Praying the unfailing prayer. Now, there's a series of books that's been written over the last 20 years or so called The Mitford Years. Imagine maybe some of you have read those books. It's a series about the little town of Mitford in North Carolina, and the main character is an Episcopal priest named Father Tim. And throughout the course of these books, the characters face some perplexing and challenging situations, and so Father Tim and his wife Cynthia will often say, well, we need to pray the unfailing prayer. And the unfailing prayer is exactly the prayer that Jesus prays. May your will be done. Not what we want, but what you want. You know, many of the battles that you might face, I suspect, feel external. They feel like they're out there. It's because of that person out there. It's because of those circumstances out there. But I wonder if sometimes the bigger battle is not with the person, the forces out there, but it's within. Within me, within you. Sometimes when we're facing a battle, we know what to do, don't we? We know where to go. We know to whom we should turn. It's not that we don't know. It's not that we're clueless. We know, but it's hard. Doing what we know is the thing to do is hard. What we need is not another way out, but we need God's merciful help to do what he is calling us to do. We need an alignment between what we want and God's will. We need them to come together. The writer of Hebrews says this, gives this interesting description of what Jesus experienced when he prayed. It says, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears. That certainly describes Gethsemane, doesn't it? Tears of the one who could save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. Now, on one hand, it doesn't seem like Jesus was heard, does it? Because he prayed for another way out, and one didn't come. And yet, what did come is God strengthened him, fortified him, so that he could carry out the Father's will. He could do what he knew needed to be done. I wonder if sometimes in your life and mine, the miracle that we need The miracle isn't, you know, that amazing, astounding answer. Maybe the miracle we need is transformation of character. The union of our will with God's will, for them to line up perfectly. That's the miracle we need. We need the fortifying of our resolve to press on when we feel like we're in the Gethsemane, being crushed and pressed. I wonder if that's the miracle we need more often. Martin Luther King Jr. experienced kind of his own version of what Jesus did in Gethsemane. It was January of 1956. MLK and his family had come to Montgomery, Alabama, and they were leading the bus boycott that was going on in the city. Shortly after moving there, he's receiving hate mail, obscene phone calls, threats to his family almost every day, he said. You know, he would hear from someone that there are people in the city that are planning to kill him. Then, January 27th, he gets a phone call in the middle of the night. And a voice says, "If you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow your brains out and blow up your house." He couldn't go back to sleep after that. Surprise. And so he pours himself a cup of coffee and he sits at the kitchen table. And he relayed this years later in a sermon, how he's sitting there and he's scared to death. I mean, the paralyzing effects of fear are immense. And what he's trying to figure out in his mind is, how do I get out of Montgomery without looking like a coward? Well, he confessed that fear to God as he prayed. And he describes later on hearing a second voice, not on the phone, but the inner voice of God speaking to him and saying a few things: stand up for righteousness, stand up for justice, stand up for truth, and lo, I will be with you even until the end of the world. And he said later, that voice promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone. No, never alone, he said. He knew the voice was the voice of Jesus. And he experienced God's presence in a profound and personal way. I mean, he was the son of a minister. He had theological training. He did all those things. But this was an experience like he'd never had, of God actually meeting him personally. And he said that sense of God being with him convinced him that he could stand up without fear to face what was to come. Well, that newfound courage was tested 4 nights later. His wife and 2-month-old daughter are at home. He's at a church leading a rally for the boycott. He gets done speaking. A member of the church runs up and says, "Your house was just bombed." He races home, finds the house on fire. The front of the house has been destroyed. There are hundreds of angry black citizens of Montgomery gathering with knives, bats, bottles, and guns. The white police force is there trying to keep order. King finds his wife and daughter. They miraculously were unharmed. He finds them, he works his way through the crowd to his smoldering porch, signals for everybody to calm down. He reminds those who are armed, who came for battle, the same words that Jesus used: all who live by the sword die by the sword. And went on to say things that amazed everyone in the crowd, black and white, said, "I want you to love your enemies, Be good to them. Love them and let them know that you love them. What we are doing is right. What we are doing is just. And God is with us. And witnesses said, you know, the whole mood changed. People put down their weapons. There were tears. There was the crowd began to sing Amazing Grace. King's wife later on said, that could have been the darkest night in Montgomery's history, but she said the Spirit of God was in our hearts. MLK had preached about love. He preached about forgiveness. He had preached nonviolence before that. One historian says, now, seeing it in action, millions were touched, if not converted. And one commentator later says, the real conversion did not happen on King's bombed-out porch, but four nights earlier, in his tranquil kitchen, over a cup of coffee, where his fear was replaced by faith in the one who promised to always be with him. That experience is a little bit like the experience of Jesus in Gethsemane. In a sense, you could make the argument that the battle was not won on the cross, that the battle was not won in the empty tomb, but the battle was won in Gethsemane with passionate prayer that through which God empowered Jesus to press on. And his victory, Jesus' victory was that he chooses love. Love for the world. Love for sinners. Love for you and me. And that was his choice. It was not the soldier's choice. It was not the government's choice. It was not the religious establishment's choice. It was not the crowd's choice. It was the choice of Jesus. And so as we continue in the story, we will see him moving forward with purpose and with power. And we are the beneficiaries of it. Would you pray with me? Oh, Jesus, we celebrate your victory. The victory of your love for a broken world. And we are so grateful for the way that that victory came. Not in comfort and care, not in armed warfare, but through this trusting prayer. Jesus, may we emulate you in the battles that we face, even as we celebrate the incredible victory that you have won for our sakes, for our good, and for the glory of God. Amen.